from KQED.
This is the California Report. Good morning. I'm Danielle Venton. Today, California has one of the lowest tobacco taxes in the nation, 87 cents per cigarette pack. But tomorrow, those taxes go up by $2 a pack. Californians voted for the increase last November. Health reporter Laura Clivens has more.
Mimo Toda owns a corner store in San Francisco. Tomorrow, he expects some angry customers.
Knowing the backlash we're going to have to hear from customers is not something that any of us are looking forward to.
But Raymond Leung, a health policy attorney in Oakland, says the sticker shock is worth it.
Tobacco tax increases are one of the most effective ways to reduce smoking rates, and it's particularly effective at reducing youth smoking.
Steve Greenhut in Sacramento disagrees. He works at the free market think tank R Street. He doesn't think higher taxes will actually help people quit.
It imposes the same level of increased taxation on smokeless tobacco and on vaping products. And those products are what help a lot of people quit a very dangerous habit of cigarette smoking.
Back at Toda's store, I ask him, a smoker, if this tax would make him quit.
You know, lately it's been something I've been thinking about more seriously.
Revenues from the tax will go to Medi-Cal and programs to help people quit smoking. For the California Report, I'm Laura Clivens.
Democrats in Sacramento hit the road yesterday to make their case for a $52 billion road repair bill that could be voted on next week. Here's Governor Jerry Brown campaigning yesterday in the Bay Area.
This is not about a controversial item. Almost everybody in Sacramento believes it. Nothing is more agreed to than making sure our roads are safe.
The measure would pay for the fixes by hiking California's gas tax by 12 cents a gallon. And that's not something everybody in Sacramento believes in. That includes Bakersfield Assemblyman Vince Fong, who joins us now. Good morning, Assemblyman.
Good morning.
Let's start here. Both Democrats and Republicans agree that California's roads are in need of a fix. But you say that the state already has the money it needs to fix the problem. Tell us what you mean by that.
If you look at the amount of money that is already spent, we have the revenue in the general fund to fund our road projects and to get the job done. What the governor and what Sacramento Democrats have proposed is, if not the largest gas tax increase in state history, one of them. And it's a lose-lose proposition for California drivers. We already pay one of the highest gas taxes in the country, and we don't have the best roads currently. What are we spending our money on?
California hasn't increased its gas tax in more than two decades. You know, it's not surprising considering it's something that consumers feel directly. Do you think that Democrats who vote for this plan will pay a political price down the road?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think that there is a lot of frustration out in California throughout the state of where does our money go when you and I and everyone go to the gas station and we fill up, you know, our cars. We expect every penny that we pay to go to roads. When we see truckers driving up and down the 5 or the 99 and they're paying their weight fees for the products they're delivering to communities all over the state, we expect every dollar of those weight fees to go to roads as well. But $1.1 billion of that is collected out of the weight fees, for example, and all that money goes to the general fund. It does not go to roads.
And so your plan would mean less money in the general fund. So that would then mean cuts elsewhere.
And to that point, we certainly should evaluate our budget. But if transportation is the number one issue, and if infrastructure needs are so bad, which we all agree it is, and we need to rebuild California, then we need to reevaluate our budget priorities and look at where we should invest taxpayer dollars.
Now, Democrats have supermajorities in both houses, and so they might be able to get this measure through without any Republican votes. Are there any changes that could be made in the next week to this plan that would make you consider getting behind it?
Well, it's not a foregone conclusion. I mean, certainly the Democrats in the state legislature have a supermajority. But if you talk to Democrats, and I've talked to many of my friends across the aisle, they know that an increase in the gas and the diesel tax and an increase in the vehicle license fee is extremely regressive. These taxes hurt low and middle income families the most. You know, 12 cents a gallon, 20 cents for diesel. Diesel excise tax of 4%, vehicle license fees that could go up to $175 a year in addition to what you already pay. I mean, these are really significant numbers, and we're asking Californians to pay more for the status quo.
Assemblyman Vince Fong, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
President Trump's nominee for Secretary of Agriculture, former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue, seems on his way to being confirmed after passing a key hurdle in the Senate yesterday. California's farming industry largely backs Perdue, but some local environmentalists are unhappy his confirmation is now running smoothly. KQED's Ted Goldberg has been reporting on this and is here to tell us more. Good morning, Ted.
Good to be with you.
Let's start with agriculture. It's a $50 billion industry here in California. Is Perdue mostly liked by the ag industry?
Well, yesterday when the Senate Agricultural Committee backed his confirmation, two major industry groups, the California Farm Bureau and Western Growers, issued statements, both applauding the move. They have been waiting months now for Perdue to get into his spot as the Secretary of Agriculture during the 2 months since President Trump nominated him. And now the California Farm Bureau and other industry groups have basically had nobody to lobby. I spoke with California Farm Bureau President Paul Wenger. This is what he had to say.
We just need to get somebody in there, and we think Sonny Perdue understands a lot of the products we have here. They do have specialty crops there, peaches and other things. They do have a need for immigrant labor, and so we think he understands a lot of the issues that we have here in California.
What's interesting there is that he was pointing out the issue of immigration. The Western Growers industry group also pointed that out. And it turns out that Sonny Perdue has a little bit more mild views on immigration compared to his upcoming, we expect, boss, Donald Trump. And so I think that farming groups here are thinking that when it comes to the issue of immigration, the guy at the top of the Agriculture Department is not going to be as strict as President Trump.
But now, not everyone thinks he's a great candidate. What are some of the concerns we're hearing from environmental groups?
Well, the concerns they have are basically what put the whole thing on delay. Sonny Perdue has come under fire for not necessarily separating his business interests with his government interests. He made a deal with the Office of Governmental Ethics that basically led to this recent hearing that led to yesterday's vote. But the organization Friends of the Earth, which is based in Berkeley, issued a statement yesterday, and I'll read something from their president. It says, you're allowing the Trump administration to smoothly confirm a nominee dogged by ethics complaints and vexed with deep personal ties to big agribusiness is reprehensible.
Now, you've covered some of the food safety issues that fall under the Department of Agriculture, including the nationwide meat recall of Rancho Feeding Corporation, which is based here in the Bay Area. What do you think we can expect from Sonny Perdue when it comes to food safety?
It's interesting. When I reached out to one of the food safety advocates that we had communicated with on the heels of that massive meat recall, I was expecting him to oppose Perdue's nomination. But what I was told from this organization is that they're actually pretty happy, at least for now. I would say cautiously optimistic. Sonny Perdue is a veterinarian. He's got training in food safety. And even though President Trump's budget makes pretty big cuts to the Department of Agriculture, the specific office that handles meat inspections is being saved for now.
Well, thank you for talking with us, Ted.
Thank you.
The idea of a tobacco tax being popular enough to pass on a statewide ballot might not have been possible if it wasn't for research showing the heavy toll of smoking. It was the work of Dorothy Rice, the first female director of the National Center for Health Statistics, that helped the states win a $200 billion settlement against the tobacco industry in the 90s. Earlier in her career, she was instrumental in making the case for creating Medicare. Rice died recently in Oakland. To speak about her legacy, we have Wendy Max with us. She's a professor of health economics and the director of the Institute for Health and Aging at UC San Francisco. She worked with Rice for 30 years. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So Dorothy Rice had an important role in convincing the federal government that the country needed Medicare. Can you walk us through how she did that?
Well, Dorothy was a statistician and a health economist, and she was into data. So she would analyze surveys and she would, you know, figure out what the message behind these surveys was. So she had done an analysis of the survey on aging in the early 1960s, which showed that half of the older population didn't have any insurance at all. And the other half, which was, you know, 8 or 9 million people, had insurance, but it wasn't really adequate. And that's just an example of the kind of information that, you know, she was able to glean from the numbers. And that's what Dorothy did throughout her whole career. She brought numbers to life and helped us understand what we needed to do on the basis of the data.
One of the things she was able to do at UCSF was to work out methods to calculate how much treating a specific disease cost, something like AIDS or lung cancer. Mm-hmm. How do you start with that? I mean, that seems so complicated.
You know, Dorothy joked at one point that if there's a disease, she's estimated the cost of it. I mean, it was using data that were available. So she would look at, for example, hospital discharge data to see how many people had been discharged with a diagnosis of, say, lung cancer. And then she would look at what the hospital bill looked like for that.
Now, you worked together on calculating the economic cost of smoking, which had a big impact. Can you tell us about that work?
Yes. One of the earlier studies that I worked on with Dorothy was to estimate the cost of smoking in California. She had previously done a study estimating the cost in the United States, but Dorothy and I began working in California when Proposition 99 passed in 1988, I think it passed, implemented in 89. Money was set aside for research, and they established this whole research program, the Tobacco-Related Disease Research Program. And Dorothy and I got a grant from them in the very first cycle where we came up with estimates for each of California's 58 counties. And it proved really useful for policy purposes. A lot of policy is made at the county or sometimes even a more local level. So we used the cost of illness approach. We looked at hospital discharge data, other data for California to come up with healthcare costs. And we also included the value of time people lose from work or other or housekeeping, other activities because they're sick with smoking related diseases. And then we looked at the value, the lost productivity from people who die prematurely.
That settlement that you got, a huge settlement against
the, I didn't get it.
No,
I wish.
Right. But that collectively your data was important. What did she think about that in the end?
Well, the settlement ultimately was, I think, about $250 billion to be paid out over 25 years. You know, when you looked at the healthcare costs and the long-term impact of smoking on people's lives. You know, I think Dorothy was pleased that it was as big as it was, but was disappointed that it wasn't even larger.
That was Wendy Max, director of the Institute for Health and Aging at UC San Francisco, talking about Dorothy Rice. And finally today, a correction. A story we aired last week misstated how much methane comes from oil and gas operations in California. While that is the largest single source of methane emissions nationwide, here in California, oil and gas production is the third biggest share, after livestock and landfills, according to the State Air Resources Board. The rainy winter has been good to California's deserts, producing a wildflower superbloom. California Report intern Sarah Craig checked it out on a recent camping trip in the Mojave Desert.
Should we start our hike?
Let's walk out this way.
Okay.
My sister and I meet up with wildlife expert David Lamfrum. He's the director of the National Parks Conservation Association and knows exactly where to find blooms.
So check out this. So there's bugs all over it, right?
Oh, wow.
Because it's wet. Feel these flowers.
Look at that big bug.
Woo! Look at that. Like, that sound, for folks listening, that's the sound of two people getting really scared by an explosion of bugs.
Bug populations are spiking along with all the blooms. And a lot of the feasting happens at night when thousands of moths drink the yucca's nectar. But it's not just moths who are getting their fill.
So you're a moth. You're trying to make it. It's a great time to be a moth, right? Mm-hmm. Super bloom. There's all these resources. But there's still bats out trying to get you. When you have these blooms, it's not just boom times for, you know, the animals that eat these plants. It's also boom times for the predators that eat those animals.
For the plants and animals alike, it comes down to when it rains and how much. This year was so great because this winter the desert got nearly all of its annual rainfall in the span of a few weeks. And this spring it warmed up, but it didn't get too hot.
It's like every 10 years all the animals and plants hit the lottery and they have so much.
It's true. And as I head back to our car, a sudden movement catches my eye.
Oh, whoa, look at this. What? It's a huge lizard.
Yeah, nice. So this is a desert spiny lizard.
Wow.
He just came out.
It's huge. It's so cool. Yeah. Wow. Is he eating bugs?
He's eating bugs.
Or flowers?
He's eating bugs. So the desert spiny has like kind of this beautiful, these like, it has really big scales and really, really, they're really iridescent right now. The sun is shining directly on the lizard. It's cold outside. The lizard has just come out. The lizard lives inside of this yucca. He just came out in the morning to get his newspaper. You can see with the yuccas, right? Like after, you can see that the how sharp they are, and then as the leaves age, they fall down, and they create what almost looks like a dress.
A while later, we say goodbye to David Lamfrom, our guide to the buzz of activity during this year's super bloom. For the California Report, I'm Sarah Craig in the Mojave Desert.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children and youth at risk. Block Construction, a builder committed to enhancing communities in the Bay Area and Central Coast. BLACH.com. Block Construction, together building greatness. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
And that's the California Report for Friday, March 31st, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman, Katie McMurrin, and Seal Muller. I'm Danielle Venton.